kids. That's Segundo here, and shortly after I emerged from my mother's womb, I knew my first name was Stephen. Thus, Stephen was missing for much of my life, as was my father, as was my general understanding of the way that language functioned. Of course, my name was not Stephen, it was Bat. It always has been Bat. I never said I was perfect, and I certainly wasn't nearly as smart as Stephen Pinker, who is a Stephen of a different caliber. Not only does Stephen Pinker know that his first name is Stephen, but he knows that his second name is Pinker. And he knows many other things that would cause any reasonable person's head to explode. Thankfully, our young roving correspondent was up to the task, mostly anyway, of getting at the stuff of thought. Although Stephen Pinker was hesitant to use the word stuff, because Harvard people aren't fond of this word, even if they are using it in their book titles.
Okay, so I'm here with Stephen Pinker, who is the author of The Language Instinct, and it's his most recently, The Stuff of Thought. Stephen, how are you doing?
Fine, thanks.
We're actually here in a Starbucks, and maybe you might want to remark upon the way that they have sort of absconded with this small, medium, large for their purposes. This is a great example here that brings us to this notion of taxonomies and how names sorts of stick. So what are your thoughts on the subject? I mean, I don't think you've ever been asked this. So,
you know. Never been asked this question before, but I think I actually do mention Starbucks late in the book in terms of someone once calculated that there are more than 20,000 different ways of ordering a coffee at Starbucks.
Yeah.
From multiplying out the type of coffee, decaf or not, different kinds of milk, different styles, and so on. And I use that as an analogy of how productive our thoughts and sentences are, because even if we are stuck with a finite inventory of basic thoughts, our ability to combine them opens up a whole world of brand new thoughts that we can entertain and that we can express in words by rearranging them in new combinations.
You missed out on the opportunity to probably mention this by the infamous L.A. Story line where Steve Martin orders that half-calf, half-decaf beverage. I'm sure you remember that.
Yes.
Well, I wonder, let's talk about some of the sort of, I guess, basics in this book. There's quite a lot to talk about, and I'll do my best to try to at least get into as many of the subjects as we can. But I wanted to actually start not just with the Starbucks notion, but also I noticed a headline this morning when I was doing my newsfeed rounds, and it said, Novelist ABC Unite for Divorce Project. And when I read this, I said to myself, divorce project. Is this some sort of kind of thing involving knitting or some craftsmanship? And I couldn't actually focus in on the fact that it was a project. I just kept thinking that it was taking this rueful, terrible sort of thing that involves humiliation, that involves financial woes, and they're applying this to something that is, I guess, benign, like projects. So based off of a perception that I would have, or perhaps someone else would have over something like this, I wonder if I might be subscribing to a certain kind of perceptive illusion that causes these sorts of things. Like, if it were phrased in another way, perhaps, I don't know, a marriage project, maybe it would not have that sort of ridiculous kind of irony attached. What causes such a perception like this to happen in terms of like a sort of noun phrase like this?
Well, you might even remember from English composition class where they said that every word has a denotation and a connotation, where the denotation is what it literally refers to, but the connotation is the emotional coloring that suffuses the word. And words that refer to the same thing can have clearly different connotations, as in, I am slender, but you are scrawny. Or I am exploring my sexuality and you're a slut.
Yeah.
And that goes into obscenity and taboo language because, for example, the FCC will allow you to talk about copulation and feces and urination, but won't allow you to say fucking shit and piss.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But I mean, I'm wondering if it's sort of a kind of a situation in which the modifier of divorce to project actually causes such a connotation in this kind of hypothetical example. I mean, this is where word units become really tricky, you know?
That's right. They do, and often the, in fact, I have a discussion in the Stuff of Thought of the phenomenon of polysemy, many meanings, where a word can take on a different meaning depending on its context in the sentence. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I can say that John's book is interesting and John's book weighs 5 pounds, but I'm obviously using, well, not so obviously, I am using book in a very different sense in those two phrases. Mm-hmm. I guess it's not obvious. We don't think about it until it's pointed out to us, but in one case, I'm referring to a book as a physical object, the other as a collection of information.
I was going to actually ask you about Polysemy because Dick Headbridge wrote this interesting book involving subcultures and how certain subcultures won't actually take upon the meaning of a particular noun or a particular, any kind of word that has multiple meanings along the lines of a polysemy sort of nature. And I was wondering why you didn't so much address this aspect of polysemy in the book, or do you have any particular thoughts on sort of the exclusionary aspects of meaning?
Yeah, so often words can be used in senses that are designed to create an in-group. That's true of campus slang, which changes as people graduate and new people come in. They don't want to sound like their elders of 5 or 10 years older. So terms for something that you deem excellent in a special kind of way. So groovy was used in the 60s. And then, you know, far out would date you. Then the cat's pajamas or hep would have been earlier, and fat and da bomb are more recent.
Yeah.
These things turn over precisely because as they escape from the subculture that invents them, and every mom in a shopping mall starts to use them, you have to look for some new form of jargon or slang to identify you as one of the hipwazee. It's a treadmill because no sooner does a term sound hip than everyone wants to use it, which makes it unhip. Just like fashions, hairstyles, and names for children, I argue, in a chapter on naming.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's also the aspect of euphemism, such as the ham sandwich on table 16, which you also mentioned in that chapter on polysemy. And I was wondering about going back to this idea of something that is polysemy-like, but is also sort of fixed within a particular group or within a particular sort of vocation or something along those lines. How does something like, I need to go ahead and take care of the ham sandwich on table 16, how does something like that actually enter the mainstream lexicon, or what causes something to be more colloquially polysemic? Is that
polysemous?
Polysemous.
Polysemous.
That makes sense. How does something become colloquially polysemous versus something that actually kind of expands into the great sort of vernacular?
Yeah, it's largely unpredictable. Where words come from in general is predictable. People can try to add a word to the language, but they will often fail. Like in the 1990s, there was the word to Gingrich, meaning to use some kind of manipulative political exploitation named after Newt Gingrich, but obviously never caught on.
Yeah.
Al Gore used to talk about the information superhighway, what we now refer to as the internet, the World Wide Web.
Fortunately, as you point out, not the infobomb. You know?
Or the infobomb, that. Anyone who lived through the 90s heard that word. But it did not catch on.
Yeah.
But it's very hard to predict which words do catch on. What we're doing right now, a podcast, is obviously a pun on broadcast, so it's a kind of a silly source for a word, but it did catch on, as did blog, which is a short for web log, and which cuts the word in the wrong place according to traditional rules of grammar. The word to spam, or the noun spam for bulk email, originated in a Monty Python sketch in which a waitress just mindlessly repeated the word spam in going through a restaurant menu. That reminded someone of the mindless repetition of automatic Usenet postings in the 80s. And then from the culture of computer hackers, it escaped to the population at large. And now it's obviously more popular referring to bulk email than referring to spiced ham, the luncheon meat.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of caprice that goes into it. It's almost impossible to predict what will succeed and what will fail.
But are there certain sorts of, is there kind of a sort of standardized test that you can apply, or is it just really that random?
I think there's a huge amount of randomness in it. That if you try to predict what words will succeed based on formulas like, well, does it fill a communicative need? Is there a concept that everyone needs to talk about? Well, that doesn't work because 40 years after the sexual revolution, we still don't have a really good word for unmarried heterosexual partners.
Sure.
You know, if I refer to my roommate, that isn't quite right. If I refer to my lover, it's a little too romantic. You know, my paramour. There was a brief fad for apostle Q from the census designation persons of opposite sex sharing living quarters. We really need this term, but there isn't one.
Yeah.
There isn't a term for the first decade of the 21st century. The zeros, the aughts, the noughts, the double zeros, the OOs, nothing has caught on.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there are concepts that have pretty much disappeared, but the word is still around, like a zoot suit. No one wears a zoot suit, but probably most people can know what the word zoot suit means. Or caboose. Trains don't have cabooses anymore, but everyone knows what the word caboose means.
And then there are words like nice, for example, which actually change meaning over the course of like of the last 500 years, where nice was originally meant in as a pejorative sense of like someone who is too stuffy, and then now we use it, and it flip-flopped actually between good and bad, good and bad.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh,
that's
really?
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, how do things like, this kind of brings into a sort of another question, because you deal at length with verbs in the first 75 pages of the book, and I actually wanted to ask you, and specifically the locative elements of a verb that causes it to be used only in a sort of set manner. And so I'm wondering, is it really the verb that kind of causes more evolution in the English language over the noun? Or
yes, well, verbs, and I discuss the major parts of speech. Each one of them is a window into a different aspect of cognition.
Yeah.
So nouns tell us something about a concept of matter. Verbs tell us something about a concept of causality. Prepositions are related to space. Tense is related to time. And so I do kind of cognitive psychology via grammar,
yeah,
basically. But there is a difference between verbs and nouns that you pointed out, which is that verbs tend to be more complex, more fluid, and more variable than nouns. If you take a passage of English, translate it into French, then get someone to translate the French back into English, you get the nouns back pretty much verbatim. The verbs are all over the place. They don't have exact translations in different languages. Anyone who learns French, for example, has to learn that the word faire, F-A-I-R-E, can mean either to do or to make, whereas in English we have different words for those two subsenses of faire. And that's just a tip of an iceberg of how different elements of meaning, cause, change, goal, are packaged together in different verbs in different combinations.
There's also this really interesting idea of the locative quality of, or the temporal quality of a verb actually not having any real effect. Like, for example, you say that, you know, you can say, don't Google me, legitimately now, but you can't say, don't giggle me. And we're dealing with something that is literally just only a vowel difference. So are verbs like hopelessly locked in this kind of locative aspect, or are there sort of connotative qualities that can probably permit either don't giggle me to possibly catch on in the future? Or is this just something that just, again, it's one of those great unknowns that can't be tracked, and all we have at the present time is the current sort of locative qualities that we can attach to the verbs to at least try to understand where it works and perhaps have a better dealing for what it is in the future?
Well, all languages have a mixture of what is purely arbitrary. The meaning of an individual word is just something that you have to do by brute force memorization. The word duck doesn't look like a duck or walk like a duck or quack like a duck. The only reason that I can use it to get you to think the thought of a duck is that both of us have memorized the association between that word and that concept as children. And which words catch on in a language so that whether it's going to be duck or canard or kochka or really does depend on the quirks of history.
Yeah.
But we don't just memorize in language. We also combine things according to rules. And that's the part where there is much more predictability. If I say the dog bit the man or the man bit the dog, you don't have to have memorized either of those sentences to know the difference. You can decode them according to the rules of subject, verb, and object to get the image that I want you to get. And if it wasn't for that, language would not be useful as a way of exchanging new ideas. We'd be stuck to a fixed list of ideas for which there were already symbols entrenched in the language. Thanks to grammatical combination, this goes back to the Starbucks analogy.
Yeah.
Just as there are 20,000 different cups of coffee at Starbucks, not because their menu has 20,000 items, but by combining numerous options, at every position in a sentence, the number of different sentences that you can say and hence the number of thoughts you can express explodes exponentially. Now, there's some things that are in between. So even though there are that are not completely rule-governed but not completely arbitrary either, and you mentioned don't giggle me,
yeah,
in other words, don't make me giggle, you can alternate between verbs for things that happen and verbs for causing something to happen, for lots and lots of verbs. You can say the butter melted, I melted the butter. The ball bounced, I bounced the ball. The puck slid, I slid the puck. But you can't say the baby giggled, I giggled the baby.
Yeah.
So it is almost a rule. It applies to lots and lots of verbs. And if you ever use an Apple computer, you'll get messages like hover the mouse over this window, or to sleep the computer, press this button. And those are innovations. A few years ago, you couldn't use hover as a transitive verb.
Yeah.
Something hovered, but not hover the mouse. So there is some rule-governed creativity or productivity, but it is limited in some subtle ways that I spent a lot of my life trying to figure out, and
yeah.
which I discuss briefly in the book. And I think I'll spare our listeners what those restrictions are, except for the fact that they involve very basic cognitive distinctions, like between causing something to move and causing something to change, between causing someone to have something and causing something to go to someone, between something just happening and it being caused to happen. Very, very, in some ways, basic logical distinctions drive these very subtle quirks of how you use verbs.
Yeah, yeah. But also even with nouns, you also mentioned the example of cunny, which was too close to another word, cunt, that was this term for rabbit that did not catch on, perhaps because of this particular association. So it's almost as if language is kind of both at it's at its wit's end for a couple of reasons. One, you have these limitations of, in terms of like locative context, but also this sort of pressing idea of what you can say and what you can't say. And yet if you look at something like the word fuck, now in 50 years, as you again point out in the book, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn, 1939.
Yeah.
People say that on television. It's no different from darn, really, these days.
Yeah. Well, it is an interesting question why some words seem automatically offensive,
yeah. But
their synonyms don't. We alluded to this earlier in the conversation and talking about connotation and denotation. What is the difference between cunt and vagina, or between copulate and fuck?
Yeah.
They refer to the same thing. Granted, since sexuality is so charged in most of the world's cultures, you don't talk about it casually. But why would the particular word you choose make a difference?
Yeah.
And what I suggest is that the word not only refers to the emotionally charged concept, but the taboo word, like fuck or cunt, does it with the additional recognition that the speaker is using that word in order to make you think about the emotionally charged aspect of it.
Yeah.
So there's an extra layer of communication above and beyond what you're referring to. Namely, I'm saying this in order to offend you or to get a rise out of you. And that, I think it taps into a basic principle of the way the brain treats language. Namely, the words are processed automatically. You can't not hear all of the connotations of a word when someone uses it. You can't will yourself not to hear a word as a word. And so our very ability to very talent at analyzing language makes us vulnerable to someone else hijacking our brain, almost giving us a little electric shock by choosing a word that we can't not interpret in terms of its unpleasant or emotional content, as in swear words.
Yes.
And the other phenomenon you mentioned of, say, a word like cunny dropping out of the language, presumably because it sounded too close to cunt,
yeah. Is
a widespread phenomenon that actually shapes the language over time. It's almost like a linguistic version of Gresham's Law, where bad money drives good money out of circulation. Bad senses of words drive good senses out of circulation. So other kind of old-fashioned words for animals are dropping out of the language. Ass for donkey,
yeah. Cock
for rooster. Many people change their last name or the pronunciation of their last name in order to avoid it sounding too much like a taboo word, like former Mayor Ed Koch.
Yeah.
Now, there's no language in which K-O-C-H is really pronounced Koch, but obviously the similarity to cock was too...
I've heard it pronounced Coke as well, you know.
Yeah. Sometimes Coke, sometimes Cook, people
yeah. Pronounce
it. Sometimes they just change their name altogether. Louisa May Alcott's family, the name was originally Alcox,
yeah. But
they changed it to Alcott, presumably for that reason. And nowadays, I think what we're going to see that happen to words like queer,
yeah. Which
you can't really use anymore to mean unusual, or gay,
yeah.
that the... and the controversy a few years ago over the use of the word niggardly, which actually has nothing to do with the N-word at all. It's a sheer coincidence. Yeah. But I think it's doomed, even though it's perfectly innocent through no fault of its own, just because it's so similar to nigger, people are not going to use it.
But here's the interesting thing, and you also mention in the book, you cite Lenny Bruce many times, you specifically point out that his idealism that if we were to use to fuck or to come, that it would actually result in everything being okay. But as you point out, no, it's actually been just the reverse. There's more venereal disease, more heartache, the like. Simultaneously, you brought up the use of the word nigger, but without mentioning Lenny Bruce's nigger routine, which I'm sure you're familiar with, where he asks, really? Because he basically...
I didn't hear that one, no.
No, he basically started this routine where he's saying, how many niggers we got in the room? And he went and proceeded to go and said, we got a few wops here, a few niggers here, a few kikes here. And funny, when you say the word so often, it kind of loses its meaning. I don't, you know, and that was basically the whole point of the actual routine.
Ah, yes, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So what I'm wondering is if he may, maybe in a verb sense, he may have been overly idealistic, but as you point out here, gay and lesbian groups have adopted the word queer, and it has lost much of its pejorative edge over the course of the years. Cannot something happen as well with nigger if people just actually go ahead and just not pay attention to these pejorative words and not put the stigma upon it?
It could, in theory, that's right. Although the use of these pejorative words by the group itself is a little bit different.
Yeah, yeah.
Is a little bit different in that you got to be very careful who you are when you use such a word. And I talk about the scene in Rush Hour in which Jackie Chan, playing a Hong Kong detective, follows the lead of his African-American partner in a tough L.A. bar.
Yeah.
His partner, Chris Tucker, says to each patron of the bar, what's up, my nigger? What's up, my nigger?
Yeah.
And so Jackie Chan says, following his lead, says, what's up, my nigger?
Yeah.
And the character said, stares him down. What did you just say? Starts a whole riot.
Yeah.
So you got to be very careful who you say it, who says it. And these taboo terms can be reclaimed as a sign of defiance. Namely, I am so little hurt by this epithet that I can use it myself. On the other hand, if it is used by an out-group member in a hurtful way, it can still be offensive.
Yeah.
So I think that often isn't necessarily the route to sanitizing a taboo term, because it's still charged if anyone but the targeted group uses it. But you're right that they can lose their sting over time, as we've seen with religious curses like damn, Jesus Christ, God, and so on.
God zooks and zounds, too.
God zooks and zounds even earlier, yeah.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is that what we're seeing with this particular word is that even the Comedy Store, if you perform at the Comedy Store in Los Angeles, they're going to fine you if you use this word. This was over the Michael Richards incident.
Oh, yes, that's right.
So it's, Kramer, if anything, what we are seeing with this particular word is that there's more stigma attached to it. But I want to actually ask you about these dysphemisms. Is that's correct? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The dysphemisms, I'm wondering let's say we were to go ahead and remove the stigma, would just new dysphemisms come up to replace it? Is this kind of like an inevitable part of the English language or any language?
I suspect that dysphemisms, which is, a dysphemism is the opposite of a euphemism. A euphemism is a word that you choose in order to prevent your listener from thinking about the disagreeable aspect of some reference. So, you know, feces, make love, pee are all euphemisms. Dysphemism does the opposite. It deliberately calls attention to the most disagreeable or emotionally charged aspect of the word. And there's sometimes in life when the time for politeness has passed and you want to remind your leader, your listener, of how awful something is. If someone is letting his dog foul up my rose garden, I might lean out the window and say, stop letting your dog shit on my roses.
Yeah.
I don't want to cover up how awful feces is at that moment. I want to emphasize it.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you can imagine a wife looking at her husband's email and saying, so while I've been taking care of the kids, you've been fucking your secretary. She's being offensive, but she wants to be offensive, and the beauty of the English language is it gives us the tools to be offensive on those occasions when we need to be. Mm-hmm. So there is a need for terms that are intended as offensive And that's why I think they survive in the language.
Yeah, there'll always be shock value, I suppose. I actually wanted to ask you about, you use the web quite frequently in this book for examples. You point out that for anyone who is interested in linguistics, here is this great depository of terminology. In fact, you even cop to actually really being a fan of sites along the lines of Overheard in New York, where people actually sort of post dialogue that they overhear that is just really fascinating and all of that. But I have to ask you if the web is actually a true reflective prism for which one can actually look at the many sorts of cultures and undercurrents, and even the people who don't have access to the web. Is this really a reflective device? Not only that, but also with the people who run a site like Overheard in New York, well, they're making a selection. So in terms of tracking memes, perhaps some memes are not trackable. So as someone who is interested in language, what steps do you do to keep the floodgates open, or is this just kind of an inevitability of language?
Yeah. Well, for the I use Overheard in New York for specific purpose of showing how strange are the things that people can say.
Sure.
So that's a case in which I didn't have to worry about how representative it was. I chose those examples precisely because they were not representative, to show how outlandish are the kinds of things you could use language to express. But you're certainly right that the language on the web is not a random sample of all of the language used among people. It's only people who have access to the internet and actually contribute to content on the web. So you do have to be careful in interpreting how representative language is when you pick it up on the web. On the other hand, it is certainly more representative than, say, LexisNexis, which only samples, say, basically newspapers and other publications,
sure,
or the kinds of databases that people in my field, psycholinguistics, tend to use, like the Brown Corpus, which is based on a collection of magazines, textbooks, newspapers, and so on. The web is more democratic than that, because any Yahoo can set up his own website. And so you get, I think, a much broader range of language, including many common errors that are easier to document on the web than they would be in a more conventional source of text like LexisNexis.
But is there some sort of danger in any medium, whether it be newspapers? And I agree with you. Like, I'll look at William Safire's language column in the New York Times, and I'll say, oh boy, it's good to see that he's about, you know, he's 6 months behind a particular trend that's going on in terms of language that's been proliferating on the streets. So I guess, is this a sort of danger for anyone following linguistics to try, you know, you're constantly going to be behind the curve if you're looking at these sort of recorded mediums that are trying to, and not only that, but also you're dealing with written language as opposed to spoken language. So how do you deal with these disparities?
Well, a general rule of thumb in linguistics is that everything is older than you think. If you actually track down, and here LexisNexis is useful, and other sources of written text, things that people say, isn't it awful the way the kids are saying so-and-so these days? And if you actually go to the records, you find that it's not the kids today, but it's actually the generation of the person making the complaint, or perhaps even the generation of his or her parents.
Yeah.
So to give you an example, everyone complains now about how kids overuse like. They interrupt their speech with like too often. But I've got enough of a memory to know that that was a complaint that people said about my generation when I was a kid in the 1960s, and it's even older than that. My favorite example is, I don't know if you remember in the 90s when Wayne's World came out as a movie.
Yeah.
And there's a sudden fad of saying something and then saying not as a way of saying the opposite of what you mean.
Yeah. My bad would be along those lines too.
Yeah. I don't even know where my bad is
from. I'm surprised.
I've heard of my bad, but I don't know what it's originally from.
I don't know either. And someone needs to track that down.
You know? Someone needs to track that down, yeah. Well, it turns out that Wayne and Garth did not introduce that not, that people were commenting on it back in the 19th century as a speech style, including the nasal pronunciation not, deliberate attempt to say something and then negate it with not afterwards. That is really the rule, not the exception. And people just don't have any way in their own experience of tracking how old an innovation is in a language, but they generally go back much farther than you think.
You respond to many of Jerry Fodor's cognitive theories, and you compare his approach to a trampoline, and you respond to his extreme nativism by observing that language can be arranged in more reductive units than he actually allows for. But actually, I wanted to ask you, how reductive can one get with language? Does it go back down to suffixes? letters? I mean, is there a point where one can get too small, or what?
Well, the you can't go all. You can't just keep going uncovering layer after layer after layer. Eventually, you reach, I think, some sort of bedrock.
Yeah.
And we do know that language thrives on combinations, like the Starbucks coffees again.
Sure.
Where sentences are composed of phrases, which are composed of words. Words are composed of vowels and morphemes, which are composed of vowels and
sure.
consonants. Vowels and consonants are composed of features like voicing, the difference between s and z. Voicing probably relates to features of motor control. That is, whether you raise the root of your tongue, whether you start your vocal cords buzzing. So that would be pretty much as low as you could get while still finding something lawful in language.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've known that for a long time. The question is, can you do the same thing with meaning? Are there meaning elements in the same way that there are sound elements, namely phonological features? In the book, I argue contra my former colleague, Jerry Fodor, who argued that there are no meaning elements. Basically, every word is a meaning element.
Yeah.
So the meaning of kill is kill, the meaning of carburetor is carburetor, the meaning of trombone is trombone, that there aren't constituents or components of a word that are basic elements like features of pronunciation. I argue against them and say that there is evidence for meaning elements like cause, change, goal, act, place, and that many verb meanings can be decomposed or analyzed in terms of these more basic atoms of meaning.
Gotcha. Well, I mean, I wanted to also ask you about this idea of using the Tutsi and the Fargo scenarios to bring about these linguistic, at least, perceptions. I mean, I'm wondering, though, because you don't... They're very helpful, certainly, in finding out how one interacts with another person through the use of language. But then what of other social variables? Like, you do mention status, you do mention the politeness theory in that particular chapter. But I'm wondering if we're talking about language, does everything obviously does not come from language, but simultaneously there are these other sociological factors that could cause those particular situations to occur. So, I mean, how does one corral studying these kinds of exchanges of these colloquies with the not just the status, but also just any given circumstances?
Well, it obviously you have to understand the baseline of a particular culture. What's the norm that you, in terms of how polite you have to be if you have a completely neutral relationship with someone, and then within that culture, people can be more or less polite than the neutral baseline.
Sure.
So, and that's why so often tourists and foreigners and immigrants get into trouble. They misinterpret what's expected in the particular culture. But if it's the same culture as yourself, then often fictional plots, like in romantic comedies, often lay bare some of the relationship clashes that drive the humor in the plot, but that for someone like me, a psychologist, offer insight into what's on people's minds as they interact. So the example you mentioned from Tootsie, where when Dustin Hoffman was disguised as a woman and has a session of girl talk with his gorgeous co-star, and his co-star, played by Jessica Lange, says, "Wouldn't it be great if instead of all of this role-playing, a guy could just come up to you and say, 'I find you really attractive and I want to make love to you.'"
Yeah.
Then later in the film, when he's undisguised and just himself, he approaches the Jessica Lange character. She doesn't recognize him. And he says to her, "I find you really attractive, and I'd really like to make love to you." And she throws her glass of wine in his face.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it lays bare the systematic hypocrisy that all of us have. We all profess to long for plain speaking, for people just to get to the point and say what they mean instead of playing a lot of games.
Yeah.
But in reality, we really do want them to play a lot of games, and we get highly offended if they don't.
Well, you also take George Lakoff to task for his use of speaking to the populace in metaphors in order to actually sway them over to the Democratic side. You point out in his book that he uses metaphors to talk about metaphors, but then one can also possibly counter-argue that, well, if as you pointed out just here, if metaphors are kind of a natural part of language, again, how reductionist can one be? Is it a matter of more or less a sort of set of political circumstances that causes this more of an offense against metaphors to occur, or what?
Well, George Lakoff, like Jerry Fodor, is a psycholinguist in my field, or linguist in Lakoff's case, who I have a huge amount of respect for, although I think they just take their ideas way too far. Mm. And I think Lakoff, has more than anyone, has shown how pervasive metaphor is in everyday speech. They're not just literary ornaments, but it's almost impossible to have a conversation without using a dozen or so metaphors.
Sure.
We don't even realize it when we say the economy rose last month, or I've had to force myself to be polite, that we're using physical metaphors to talk about abstract concepts. Lakoff, I think, takes the idea very far, saying that all thought is metaphorical, or almost all, and that the way to political success is to control the metaphors, and that people are so concrete that you can get people to think of a situation in a different way if you use different metaphors. So infamously, he suggested that if the Democrats wouldn't talk about taxes, but rather membership fees, they could shake off their image as tax raisers and win the hearts of the American public. I think, fortunately, the Democrats didn't take his advice to heart.
Yeah, got you. But, I mean, I guess what I wanted to sort of suggest here is that, I mean, maybe in particularly in the political arena, you can't get away from metaphors because you have to win the next year's election. So, you know, so it's kind of like sort of an inescapable thing. I mean, maybe are there certain sorts of occupational hazards with language where there's a certain metaphor quotient for each particular thing, such as in politics or...
Yeah, I think you can't get away from metaphor, and you can't get away from analogy in teaching, in rhetoric, in science, in explaining a scientific phenomenon, like you might liken heat to a fluid, or the brain to a computer. The crucial thing is that you can pay attention to what aspects of the metaphor should be taken seriously and which ones should be ignored. And clarity and progress and truth depend on not being seduced by metaphors, to use them as a communicative device, but to be clear about which aspects you take seriously and which ones you ignore. So I'll give you an example close to my own field. I think that the thinking of the brain as a computational device is extremely fruitful and important.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that we should take a personal computer as a good metaphor for the brain.
Yeah.
I think the brain and the computer are similar in that both achieve intelligence by processing information, by running a kind of software. That's the aspect that's worth taking seriously, and it leads you to productive experimental questions like, what are the data formats of the brain? Do we have the equivalent of image files or text files or sound files or abstract propositions? That's a fruitful set of questions for someone like me interested in the brain. On the other hand, if you think that the brain has a CPU chip or does one thing at a time or follows precise rules that are always carried out perfectly, then you're paying attention to the wrong aspects of the metaphor. And the whole process of science often consists of differentiating the parts of an analogy that are meaningful and accurately capture reality from the ones that are excess baggage and should be ignored.
Have you observed over the last 40 years that humans in the English language have latched on more to metaphors to explain things, or is there no discernible difference? Is there, I suppose, a metaphor quotient overall throughout the course of life?
I think that language always has been metaphorical. We often don't even realize how metaphorical it is. We talk about, say, I talk about the Declaration of Independence, and I quote it and show that just about every noun phrase in the Declaration of Independence was ultimately metaphorical.
Sure.
Declare. Comes from the same word as clear, and it means to make transparent. Independence comes from the same word as pendant or pendulum, meaning hang. If you're dependent, you're hanging from something. But and the Declaration of Independence is clarifying why the American colonists no longer wanted to hang from the Brits. So, and this, of course, goes way back in the history of the language, to, in fact, in some of these cases, to Latin terms that were borrowed into English. It clearly doesn't mean that we literally have an image of the revolutionary Americans hanging on bungee cords from the Britons.
Yeah.
But it shows that metaphor is not a new thing. It's buried very deeply in our language, and it has left its mark on our current vocabulary.
Does a metaphor or colloquialism, does this determined largely by, say, for example, we were talking about Wayne's World earlier, and we're talking about the Declaration of Independence here. Is there a certain kind of, I guess I kind of want to go back to this idea of some of the sort of linguistical or grammatical or even syntactical memes that are not just under the radar versus the ones that are sort of laid down by some serious cultural or governmental institution. Does this affect things? Is there just as much innovation language-wise?
By and large, language is a grassroots phenomenon. You can fool yourself with things like the French Academy and Chicago Style Manual into thinking that language is legislated by some committee of experts.
Yeah.
But in reality, it pops up as people try to express themselves and catches on like other kinds of cultural trends and fads. And and that's a good thing, because no one is enough of a genius to design something as spectacularly expressive and beautiful as the English language in their own head.
Yeah.
It's the collective product of millions of people constantly innovating. Most of the innovations peter out. Some of them catch on and spread like any other trend or fad. And a language at any one time is the collection of all of the fads that for one reason or another have caught on in a community.
By way of its constant development and constant changes, you then would say that language is truly the unhackable construct of human beings.
Language, say that again?
Language is the unhackable construct of human beings.
Unhackable construct, yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, depending on how you interpret the word hack, it could be
that's true, yeah.
hundreds of thousands of hacks all accumulated over the centuries.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Oh, I wanted to actually talk about the Worfian hypothesis of linguistic determinism. In The Language Instinct, you basically declared this dead, and you actually returned to it in this book using Stephen Levinson's experiments with the Zeltal, I believe, speakers.
Zeltal, yes.
Zeltal, thank you. I'm wondering if language does not completely determine thought, and that thought also involves these spatial aspects that are in these particular experiments, is there a way to commingle the Worfian hypothesis? Because Worf actually mentioned natural logic, so I'm wondering if there's any sort of way to corral some of the tenets of the Worfian hypothesis with these spatial elements, some of these post-Worfian ideas.
Yeah, well, I think that the problem with the idea that our language determines our thought is that there are so many ways in which our language can affect our thought that it's easy to confuse some of the common sense ways with very radical hypotheses. I mean, just to take two ends of the continuum, the two extremes. As I'm talking to you, my language had better affect your thought, otherwise I'd be wasting my breath.
Yeah.
So language is a way of affecting someone's thoughts. It's a way of getting ideas from one head into another. At the other extreme, there's the hypothesis that we actually think in the grammatical sentences of our language, and that if you didn't have a language, you'd be incapable of any kind of thought. And that can't be right, because we know that the children can think before they have language, that many kinds of animals can think, that if children couldn't perceive a situation without language, they couldn't learn the language in the first place. We know that the language changes where new words are invented to express ideas that people must have had before there was language, otherwise where would the words have come from in the first place?
Yeah.
So the challenge is identifying how language can affect thought. And I suspect that the main way is that either language allows us to memorize formulas that can aid in thinking. So the multiplication table, for example, is basically a way of memorizing a little bit of verse. 8 times 7 is 56, 8 times 6 is 48, and so on. And that we can offload some of the demands of memory by reciting things, keeping them in our auditory memory as a way of freeing up resources in the central executive of the brain. And I think also that when concepts are labeled by a word, it helps make them into a conceptual chunk that can be labeled by the word. And so again, you can juggle it in working memory by just keeping its label in mind as a substitute for having to ponder the entire structure of the concept every time. And so it can foster thought in that way. But that falls well short of the radical ideas that if your, say, culture doesn't have a word for something, you literally cannot think it.
Sure.
An idea that is very popular in popular culture and in the humanities.
Gotcha.
Language of prison house. There certainly is a widespread tendency for languages to use space as a way of expressing abstract ideas. I'm not sure if this is what you're alluding to. But when we say the John went from sick to well, for example, he didn't literally go anywhere. He may have been in bed the whole time. But we are conceptualizing his health as if it was a space where being sick and being well are two points, and changing your health is analogous to moving from one point to another in this abstract space. You see that all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And it suggests that our abstract thought taps into a kind of spatial reasoning that presumably we inherited from animals much simpler than ourselves.
Gotcha. But I mean, how do rigid designators fall into this scenario of abstract concepts? You take umbrage a little bit with Kripke in this.
Well, I try to explain. Actually, I endorse Kripke's theory that names are, in the jargon of philosophy, rigid designators, which is another way of saying that they don't have definitions. That although it's tempting to think that the meaning of a word is a definition, either in other words or in abstract concepts, and I think that that is true for verbs, for example. There's also an aspect of meaning that is can't be decomposed into simpler concepts, but connects to a linkage to the real world. The fact that someone points to something, dubs it, and the name sticks is essential to its meaning. The example of, say, a name is a clearest example of a rigid designator. So what does William Shakespeare mean?
Exactly.
Well, you could look up Shakespeare in a dictionary, and it would say, English playwright, 17th century, wrote Romeo and Juliet, Hamlet, etc. But let's say the Shakespeare conspiracy theorists are right, and we got conclusive proof that Shakespeare didn't write the plays attributed to him. Would you now, and let's say it was Christopher Marlowe, who was the real author of Romeo and Juliet. Would we say, now William Shakespeare refers to Christopher Marlowe, and that the guy named William in Stratford at that time is no longer William Shakespeare? We probably wouldn't think that. Or you could even let your imagination run free. Let's say Shakespeare had died at the age of 2, and so he didn't write a thing. What would the word William Shakespeare mean? Well, you'd think that it still refers to that 2-year-old or that adult who never wrote those plays. That is, when Mr. and Mrs. Shakespeare christened their child William, and everyone referred to him that way, that's what gives William Shakespeare its meaning. Its connection to that particular guy maintained by a chain of conversation from then till now. And it doesn't matter what facts are true of William Shakespeare. All that matters is that someone pointed to that baby and dubbed him with that name.
Yeah.
And it's a very different way of thinking about meaning. I think it's most linguists and semanticists would agree with Kripke that names are rigid designators. It starts to get a little more complicated when you think about other kinds of words, like water. Is the word water a rigid designator for that H2O stuff that comes out of our faucets? Or is the meaning of water what chemists call H2O?
Yeah.
There it starts, the story starts to get interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there's also this idea of the mistake of names being associated with some major cultural figure. The idea is that there's this great sort of wave of names along the lines of Marilyn or whatever that were already in the process of actually happening. There were already all these namings going on, and yet and perhaps this kind of relates to what we were talking about earlier in terms of sort of constantly being behind the curve, people, including Hillary Clinton, in this book, which you cite, she says that she was named after Sir Edmund Hillary, they naturally sort of associate it with a particular sort of figure who is actually in the process of coming of that particular sort of set. So if we're constantly sort of behind, both in terms of tracking language and in terms of, like, tracking language just in terms of names, I guess is this the sort of risk of even dealing with language? Because it's just going to constantly change, and there's just no way to track it. Even the greatest marketing person on earth couldn't possibly figure out the perfect sort of name to name something, because by that point, it's going to be something else.
Yeah, it's another example of language being very much a fashion-driven grassroots phenomenon.
Yeah.
I refer to the work of my colleague Stanley Lieberson, who wrote a book and did a lot of research on the rise and fall of the popularity of names. The fact that everyone recognizes, namely that fashions for names change every decade, and so you can guess a person's age fairly accurately based on how they're named, especially women, more so than men. So a Mildred, for example, or an Ethel, it would be a senior citizen. A Susan or a Linda or a Nancy would be a baby boomer. A Jennifer or an Amber would be 30-something. And a Caitlin or a Chloe would probably be a child.
Yeah.
And the interesting lesson from analyzing why this happens is that a lot of people have the wrong theory of cultural change. People think that fads are driven by some external cause, that perhaps biblical names became more popular in the 80s because there was a revival of religion, or that Marilyn became a popular name in the 50s because of Marilyn Monroe. But if you actually plot the trends, as Lieberson has done, you find that that doesn't work. For example, biblical names became popular in an era in which religious observance was declining. And as you noted in your question, the popularity of Marilyn rose well before Norma Jean Hibbard took Marilyn as her stage name. And so Marilyn Monroe was an effect of the popularity of Marilyn, not a cause. A lot of the variation in name popularity, and probably a lot of variation in cultural trends in general, whether men wear fat ties or skinny ties, whether women wear long skirts or short skirts, just depends on the dynamic of those very behaviors. Namely, you want to look a little bit hipper than everyone else, and so you look at what everyone else is wearing, how everyone else is wearing their hair, what they're naming their kids. You try to get a little bit of the head of the curve, but not too much. So the names in 1 year are affected by the names in the previous year. The hairstyles in 1 year are affected by the hairstyles in the previous year, but none of them are affected by some external variable that impinges on them from the greater culture.
We're talking about sort of causation in language. What do you think causes causation to these sort of false correlations? Is it really kind of an inability to sort of get that time interval, which you actually outlined, I believe, in the second chapter of the book, that the tense is constantly shifting to past and perfect, so that causation is kind of an inevitable sort of quality of language that one can't sort of get out, and so these perceptions actually kind of occur?
Well, I think we are prone to looking for causes of events. And in the chapter on verbs, I talk about the concept of causation, which we think of as kind of one billiard ball clacking into another. If John opened the window, it meant he went over, grabbed it, and lifted it up. That's our concept of causation. And then when we put on our hats as amateur sociologists and we look at a phenomenon like Jennifer becoming popular in the 1970s or Chloe becoming popular in the 1990s, we ask what billiard ball clacked into it to cause that to happen. We're not so good at figuring out endogenous dynamic patterns, such as many parents independently reacting to the names that their parents gave them, looking for something slightly different, and by something of a coincidence, something of subtle influences, push a trend in a particular direction. The kind of thing that you would need complex dynamical equations to model is the kind of thing that our intuitions aren't very good at working through.
Gotcha. Well, anyway,
How are we doing?
We're great.
Yeah, we're good.
Yeah, so, Stephen, okay. Thanks very much.
It's my pleasure, and thanks so much for having me.
Thanks.